And now, the smallest giant in the business, Mike Cannon.
Welcome back to this week's Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio program. Up next, like each and every week, I bring you at this time LGBT News Magazine, This Way Out. After that, a whole lot of shorter pieces, including Media Minutes, Radio Spin, Women's E! News, to name a few, coming up this hour. Let's get right into it, and as always, thanks for listening.
You're just in time. Enjoy the show.
I thought to, like, screech at people. I didn't think that that was going to get me anywhere, but if you could just sort of write stories about your boyfriend when he was pertinent to the story, or write about being gay when it was pertinent to the story, that seemed better.
I say I'm here now, and I'm queer now.
So I do what I do, when I am who I am.
We harm the world. We harm the children.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Australia's House okays fairness for queer couples. Humorist David Sedaris is fully engulfed by 50. And blues, pop, and parody percolate in the audiophile. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Torres.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 27th, 2008. Australia's lower house passed legislation this week to grant a number of rights to gay and lesbian couples. The Same-Sex Entitlements Bill amends dozens of Commonwealth laws. It will remove discrimination against same-gender partners in areas such as immigration, taxation, veterans' pensions, and elder care. It also abolishes discrimination against children of same-gender couples by granting equal rights to both parents. The Labor government of Prime Minister Kevin Rudd managed to fend off a proposal by the opposition Liberal Party during debate to include language in the legislation to affirm marriage as heterosexual only. Even though that's already part of Australian law, opponents expressed concern that passage of the legislation would somehow undermine the institution of marriage. Rudd's government has called the law reforms an issue of basic fairness, while repeatedly voicing its opposition to full marriage equality in Australia. The future of the Same-Sex Entitlements Bill in the Senate, the country's upper house, is uncertain.
The protracted court battle over repeal of India's anti-gay penal code, Section 377, a 148-year-old remnant of British colonial rule that outlaws carnal intercourse against the order of nature with another person of the same sex, wrapped up this week. The non-governmental HIV-AIDS advocacy NAS Foundation concluded its arguments challenging the law before the Delhi High Court, saying it violated fundamental human rights. They also charged that Section 377 enshrines homophobia in India's legal system and legitimizes the continued repression of gay men and lesbians in Indian society. The government then asked for more time to reconcile the positions of its health and home ministries, each of which submitted contradictory affidavits with the court, drawing fire from the judges. The health ministry has strongly favored repeal to further its HIV/AIDS prevention efforts among one of the country's most vulnerable groups, while the home ministry supported retention of Section 377. The law ministry finally submitted the government's formal position late this week against repeal because, they wrote, such an action will disturb the law and order situation and might create unnecessary problems in the society. One ministry official also told reporters that it acts as a deterrent against those with sick minds. The court could issue its ruling before year's end.
A group of masked assailants attacked participants at what organizers called a queer festival last week in a cultural center in the downtown Serbian capital of Belgrade. At least four people were injured, one of whom suffered a concussion and had his arm broken. Police say they've detained two suspects. Organizers had used only a website to publicize the events because they feared such violence. They praised quick action by police to break up the melee and identified the assailants in a statement this week as members of OBRAS, a clerical fascist group that also organized the attack on Pride in 2001. This year's events, which ran from September 18th through 21st, included participants from Macedonia, Russia, the Netherlands, Germany, the UK, Italy, Croatia, Greece, Slovenia, and the U.S. An independent ombudsman charged with protecting the rights of citizens in Serbia has defended the right of LGBT people to hold public gatherings. But a European Commission report on human rights in the country last year called discrimination against sexual minorities widespread.
Organizers of the first LGBT Pride Festival in Bosnia have canceled remaining events following assaults on several participants on its opening night. At least 10 people were injured this week when about 70 protesters, many hooded and shouting, "Kill the gays," attacked people attending the festival at the Academy of Fine Arts in Sarajevo. They reportedly dragged some from their cars and beat others in the streets of the Bosnian capital. One of the victims, a Danish film producer, is reportedly in serious but stable condition in the hospital. The others received treatment for cuts and bruises and were released. Q Association leader Svetlana Jerkovic told a hastily arranged news conference the next night that her sponsoring organization was canceling the rest of the festival, which was to have run for 4 days, because of security concerns. About 250 people had attended the opening night event. Posters saying "Death to Gays" appeared on Sarajevo streets earlier in the month. Amnesty International and a number of European Union officials have criticized Bosnian authorities for failing to provide adequate security at the festival, despite strong indications that there was likely to be violence. Anti-lesbi-gay religious groups, mainly Muslim, who were offended that the festival was held during the holy month of Ramadan, had warned for weeks that they would demonstrate against the festival. Police said that they had arrested 5 of the assailants.
Elsewhere, the leader of an Iraqi LGBT advocacy group was brutally murdered this week. The 27-year-old university student, known only as Bashar, was assassinated in a barbershop in Baghdad. Members of a religious militia burst into the shop, and according to leading British gay activist Peter Tatchell, writing in the Guardian newspaper, sprayed his body with bullets at point-blank range. Bashar had organized safe houses in Baghdad for dozens of gays and lesbians seeking refuge from so-called religious police in his work for the London-based advocacy group of expatriates called Iraqi LGBT. A recently released United Nations report on human rights charged that while gays and lesbians are supposed to be protected by law in Iraq, LGBT residents must live in hiding or face extreme brutality. Ali Healy, who heads up the Iraqi LGBT group in London, told a conference on homophobia in the city last year that armed wings of the two main Shia parties that control the government of Iraq routinely round up men and women, primarily in Baghdad, who are suspected of being gay or lesbian. Those men and women are never heard from again. Healy blamed those militias for the murders of hundreds of gays and lesbians and accused the U.S.-led coalition of doing little to stop the killings.
In other news, a 21-year-old lesbian has become the first person to receive an official national identity card in Nepal, listing her gender as third rather than male or female. Vishnu Adhikari received the designation last week after refusing to accept a male identity card from the Kaski District Administration Office in central Nepal, where officials claimed that she appeared to be a man. The Blue Diamond Society, the Himalayan nation's most prominent LGBT organization, called the move a landmark victory for sexual and gender minorities in Nepal. LGBT people are routinely harassed by police and are victims of extortion and other abuse in the country's conservative and generally homophobic society. Meanwhile, the national government has unveiled a budget that provides funds to accord special priority to solve the core problems of Nepali people relating to sexual and gender minorities. It includes money for a common house for 50 people to live together for their socialization. Openly gay lawmaker Sunil Pant said in an email statement that this is a very symbolic but very positive change of not just attitudes, but also of helping marginalized and oppressed sexual and gender minorities. Pant, a well-known gay activist, was elected to Nepal's 601-member Constituent Assembly in May. The Assembly is drafting a new constitution while also functioning as parliament during the process.
A U.S. district court ruled this week that the Library of Congress illegally discriminated against a qualified transgender applicant when they withdrew a job offer after she revealed her plans to transition from male to female. The American Civil Liberties Union, which represented David Schroer, who has since adopted the first name of Diane, called the ruling groundbreaking. Judge James Robertson said that by revoking the job offer, the library had violated the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which bans bias based on gender. The Library of Congress unsuccessfully attempted to have the case dismissed, claiming that transgender people are not protected under that act. The now 52-year-old Schroer retired from the military as a Special Forces commander while she was still David, and had directed a classified organization formed to track international terrorists after the September 11th attacks. She had applied for a job with the Library of Congress as a terrorism research analyst. It is especially gratifying that the court has ruled that discriminating against someone for transitioning is illegal, Schroer said in a statement. I knew all along that the 25 years of experience I gained defending our country didn't disappear when I transitioned, she added. So it was hard to understand why I was being turned down for a job doing what I do best. She now heads a consulting firm that, ironically, has contracts with several federal agencies, including the Coast Guard and the U.S. Defense Department.
And finally, New Zealand not only protects many of its minorities from discrimination, it names its select committee rooms in Parliament for them. And this week, the newest of them was officially dedicated, the Rainbow Room, honoring the contributions of LGBT people to New Zealand society. It's decorated with framed photographs depicting the struggle for LGBT civil rights in the country, on loan from the National LGBT Archives. Other rooms in Parliament House have been named to honor minorities and other previously underrepresented groups, including the Maui Tiki Tiki Ataranga Room to celebrate Native New Zealanders, the Suffrage Room to salute the country's women winning the right to vote in the late 19th century, and the Asia Room to commemorate achievements by members of that community. New Zealand law bans discrimination against LGBT people in housing and employment, includes those communities in hate crime protections, and allows same-gender civil partnerships with virtually all the rights of marriage. House Speaker Margaret Wilson said during the Rainbow Room dedication ceremony that it is appropriate that it is with select committee rooms we recognize all members of our society and the paths they have taken to full citizenship with equal rights.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 27th, 2008, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm John Torres.
Being gay without shame, we won't be afraid to go knocking on another door marked 666 later in the program.
It's striking to me, right, because I'm 51. So at the time that I grew up, if you had the word boyfriend in a book, then your book would be in the homosexual section. Well, there wouldn't even be a homosexual, so your book wouldn't even be in the library, right? And now you can just be at the bookstore at large. Just in the 50 years since I've been alive, who could have imagined those changes?
That's where we left off last week with public radio humorist David Sedaris talking about change and sharing experiences he's had touring the world with his new collection of essays, When You're Fully Engulfed in Flames. During his recent tour of Australia, Brisbane-based This Way Out correspondent John Frame was self-avowedly charmed by the self-effacing author.
I gather that you've never been sort of inclined to be a street-marching, flag-waving gay activist, but I believe that you actually do a power of good by infusing your work with just unflinching honesty regarding your sexuality. Do you get feedback that that's true?
Well, I remember when I first started on the radio in the United States, people would say, you know, you need to get on the radio, you need to talk about AIDS, and you need to talk about... But I always found like that lecturing at people like that does absolutely no good. You know, when I started on the radio, there were 10 million people that listened to this radio network within the United States. And it's a huge, I mean, for me anyway, like coming from someone who was used to reading in front of groups of 50, I mean, to go from that to 10 million, that's... But I thought to like screech at people, I didn't think that that was going to get me anywhere. But if you could just sort of write stories about your boyfriend when he was pertinent to the story, or write about being gay when it was pertinent to the story, that seemed better, because then you would have people say, well, there's that guy on the radio and I like him and he's a homosexual, so I don't see what all the big deal is about. That seemed a better way for me to go about it. You know, I mean, people have their own different ways of making things work, but if there was any way for me, that was the way to go about it. The same way as, like, I think of, like, Ellen DeGeneres just got married, right? And you've got to realize her audience in America, it's not like lesbians run home to watch Ellen DeGeneres. It's like people's moms watch Ellen DeGeneres. So when Ellen, like, gets married to another woman, that's doing more. You know, here's somebody that makes people's moms laugh. You know, here's someone that people's moms trust. And all of a sudden, she's getting married, and then maybe for the first time, they can sort of look at that and say, well, yeah, I mean, if it made Ellen happy, you know, maybe it'll make my daughter's third grade teacher happy, too.
Yeah, it'd be remarkable if the next step then from the general public thinking that it's okay to admit that you're same-sex attracted to all teachers being able to be open and honest in the workplace too. It's a shame that they're still very much having to fight against that.
Well, people just freak out when it's like with children, don't they? I mean, they just get, you know, which a lot of that goes back to the idea that the secret agenda, you know, like, I know, we'll work our way into schools, and that way we can recruit. We can't have children of our own, so we have no way of making future homosexuals. But we can twist young minds and get them to agree, and then we can pounce upon them. Which is just, when you hear things like that, it's just so ridiculous. I had this author escort. When you go on a book tour, you have somebody who picks you up at the airport and drives you around. And it's usually a doctor's wife, right? I had one in the United States, and clearly she hadn't read my book. And she started talking about politics. And then she said, seriously, David, she said, you know, with this gay wedding and gay marriage and stuff. And she said, what's the next? People will say, oh, I want to marry my dog. You know, or, oh, I want to marry a three-year-old child. That's the next step. But just that anyone would make that connection seemed like next stop, bestiality. I just, yep. But it was kind of good because, you know, like, you know, you realize most of your friends think the way that you do. And so it's actually really good to get out in the world and realize, oh, like, a lot of people think this other way. And just to hear this woman talking about it, and it's fascinating to me.
Well, you're right. It's nothing to be afraid of, and it's not as if gay lives are extraordinary. You actually describe yourself and your partner, Hugh, as being two decent people trapped in a rather dull play. You're actually now, you're past 50, and you've taken the big leap. A good quarter of When You Are Engulfed in Flames deals with giving up smoking. It's a marking point, isn't it, 50, because I'm 53, and you're thinking, well, will I get another 50?
Well, you know, it was awful to be 50, but I was never, you know, I figured like those people who were like super conscious of their bodies and like excessively vain, I always thought, well, you know, we'll see what happens when you turn 50. But I was never that way, and it was awful to be 50. It was just awful. Like, I just felt like I became a ghost. You know, you become invisible. And I don't mean invisible like, oh, no one's going to look at you across the room and think, oh, I want to have sex with him, because no one's thought that about me in 30 years. But I mean that you become, you know, like to a younger person, they'd be like, eh, it's just a bunch of old people over there. You just sort of become that. And I was in Paris a few weeks ago, and this guy got lost. He was looking for something. He was riding a bike, and he stopped me, and he asked me where La Motte Piquet was. So I told him, you know, we were speaking French, and I said, oh, it's over there, and, you know, cross that road, and it's up there. 10 minutes later, he came back. He said, I couldn't find it. And I said, well, I have a map here. And so I'm showing him on the map, and he says, oh, I detect an accent. Where are you from? And I said, oh, I'm from the United States. He says, what do you do for a living? And anyway, I was telling a friend about that later, and she said, oh, that was classic. Like, he was trying to pick you up. And it's like, I'm 50. Like, the only one who tries to pick you up when you're 50 is 80. Like, nobody wants to pick up somebody who's 50. I think he just wanted my wallet.
David Sedaris, have a fantastic time while you're here and the rest of your trip in Australia, and every success with this already top-selling book. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
David Sedaris' latest book is called When You Are Fully Engulfed in Flames. He spoke with our John Frame in Brisbane.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres, and you're listening to This Way Out, the Gay and Lesbian International News Magazine. That was without cue cards, people.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
A new This Way Out update has been posted on our website. For recent programming information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to www.thiswayout.org.
It's Music by the Numbers, with a third of three, a singer's first, and a 666 in this edition of The Audiophile.
Ever since the day I was born, I knew I was not the same. My shame turned into fear. But now times have changed and I love being queer. I say I'm here now and I'm queer now. You better get over it. I say I'm here now and I'm queer now. You better get over it.
As you can tell, this album is very out of the closet. I'm J.D. Doyle.
I'm Christopher David Trentum, and you're listening to Audiophile. Gay Adegbolola is one-third of the blues group Sapphire, the Uppity Women Blues, and now has released her third solo album called Gay Without Shame.
Well, I'm a professional blues woman. I've been doing this for about 30 years, but this time I wanted my blues community to honestly see me and to gain understanding about my struggle for acceptance. And at the same time, I want the GLBTQ community to experience the magic healing power of the blues.
You know, I was drinking at the fountain. I was drinking at the fountain of life. I could drink from the black one. I couldn't get near the white. Fountain, and you know it's still the fountain of life. I can drink at the straight one, but I can't take a wife.
Find out more about the album Gay Without Shame by Gay Adegbolola at www.adegbolola.com. And of course, I'll spell that for you. That's www.adegbolola.com.
The debut album by Barry Gould is called Knocking on Another Door.
I didn't want to go to bed. I needed time to clear my head. So west in Hollywood I went, walking and running. I stopped at Mickey's for a drink.
This album is infectious, intelligent pop that is well-produced and, gee, leaves you feeling better. That's quite a gift.
There are songs that talk about the struggles of trying to succeed. There are songs that talk about being gay. There are songs about an ex-boyfriend. There are songs about my dogs and how much they mean to me. I think the CD shows who I am, which was sort of my point in recording it. I wanted to have something that if I was to get hit by a bus tomorrow, that you'd be able to listen to this and say, that was Barry. And that's what I was trying to accomplish.
And the world keeps us spinning around and around. We're dizzy from all of the sights and the sounds. I found out I'm stronger when still. So I do what I do and I am who I am. I'm busy being the best that I can.
You can learn more about Barry Gould's album, Knockin' on Another Door, at www.barrygould.com, and Gould is spelled G-O-O-L-D.
Don't I look rich, dancing to share? Can and cold shoes on the ground, chest shaved and bare, send in the clones.
And the Kinsey Six are back with their irreverent humor and tight harmonies. Erwin Keller, who plays Winnie, gives us an update.
The new album is called 666. It's our sixth CD, and it's our least forgivable. It's got some really nasty, outrageous parodies and some interesting original songs. A lot of political stuff in this one. And most important, it has a lot of naked pictures of the Kinsey Six.
There comes a time for a Halliburton call, when the world must come together for guns. There are people dying, oh, so it's time to send more arms. Give bombs the greatest gift of all.
Let's keep the third world spending day by day.
$30 billion in sales is not chump change.
If they want food, let God make them famine free.
But the truth, you know,
guns are all they need. We arm the world, we harm the children. But giving arms will make us higher pay, so let's start giving.
Find out more about the outrageous CD 666 at www.kinsey6.com. That's www.kinseysicks.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at our new address, 594 Sawdust Road, number 273, Spring, Texas, 77380, or by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiofile.org.
Audiophile is produced by Christopher David Trentum, J.D. Doyle, and Chris Wilson. I'm Christopher David Trentum.
And I'm J.D. Doyle. Keep listening.
If you're a down and out, Bin Laden or Hussein, Dabahu, sons of arms, will turn on us again. All is well in this acid chance. To arrange to make more guns.
We'll stand hand in hand with Second World
Sons.
We are Third World.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, John Torres, Michael LeBeau, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, John Frame, Sherry Lund, and Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum contributed program material. Gay Adegbalola, Barry Gould, and the Kinsey Six performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to read an exciting update about podcasts of your favorite international LGBT radio show. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of all our programs there. To receive our weekly email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KKFI, Kansas City, Missouri, CFUR, Prince George, British Columbia, WYEP, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.
And now, the only radio commentator not addicted to illegal pain medication, nor Viagra, Mike Cannon.
The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard Mondays from 2 to 6.
My thanks to Mike Cannon at WNRB in Wausau, Wisconsin, who rebroadcast World Report.
Welcome to Media Minutes. Welcome to the weekly radio spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of cheap oil.
Women's E-News, weekly summary of news about women, women's issues, and from women's perspectives. From the weekly Cheers...
This Week in Radical History for the week of April 7th.
Get a fucking lawyer. Go get a lawyer right now.
My name is Scooter, and this is the Inner Side Radio Program.
This Week in Palestine, the service of the International Middle East Media Center.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out on WNRB, Wausau, Wisconsin.
All these programs and more can be heard each week on the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6 p.m., right here on Central Wisconsin's only non-corporate, commercial-free community radio station, 93.3 WNRB LP, Wausau. Free people, free radio.
I don't know how we do it night after night, but another great list. Guess the category tonight. Top 10 messages left on Sarah Palin's answering machine.
Oh, after the debate.
It's not easy to get stuff off of somebody else's answering machine.
Of course.
We did it. We got a guy. I can't tell you who. I can't tell you how. But we got it right here. Good. Top 10 messages. He listened to them all, and he rated them 10 to 1.
Here I see.
Yep. Here we go. Top 10 messages left on Sarah Palin's answering machine. Number 10. Hi, it's John McCain. I had to go to bed. How'd it go? And number 9. Hi, Katie Couric here. Have you thought of a Supreme Court case yet? Number 8. Hi, it's Bill Clinton. Let me know when Todd's out of town. Number 7. Number 7. My name is Joseph Sixpack. Knock it off. Number 6. Hi, Katie Couric again. Think of any newspapers yet? Number 5. Buy the Late Show Fun Facts book. It's a bridge to hilarity. Number 4. John McCain again. Could you pick up my prescriptions? Number 3. Senator Larry Craig here. Do you have Joe Biden's phone number? What? Senator, please.
I'm telling you.
Please, Senator. Number 2. McCain again. Do you remember where I parked the Straight Talk Express? And the number 1 message left on Sarah Palin's answering machine, it's President Bush. If you're at the debate, who's watching Russia? There you go.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Wireless microphones can be found just about everywhere. Theater groups, churches, amateur musicians, karaoke singers across the country use them because they're convenient and versatile. There's only one problem. They're illegal. Harold Feld of the Media Access Project says that people have no idea they may be breaking the law.
Everybody assumes that if I can walk into Radio Shack or find it on Amazon.com and buy it, that there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there is nothing that warns the everyday person who doesn't have a clue about FCC rules that what they're doing is actually a violation of federal law. They don't know they're radio pirates. They think they're just buying a wireless microphone.
Legally, the only people authorized by the FCC to use wireless mics are those people associated with the production of broadcast or cable programming or motion picture production.
It's broadcasters and roving news crews, movie producers, whoever's covering the Super Bowl and other televised sporting events.
Wireless mics operate on the empty frequencies that lie between TV channels, the so-called white spaces. As technology has made wireless mics better and cheaper, their popularity has risen. The industry estimates there are probably about 1 million wireless mics in use. Many of these mics have been illegally squatting in the white spaces, but the FCC and broadcasters have turned a blind eye. But now, those same white spaces may also be the key to providing affordable, wireless, high-speed internet services to millions of Americans. Advocates like Feld are pushing to open the white spaces for unlicensed use to create what some call Wi-Fi on steroids. But the wireless microphone industry has joined with the National Association of Broadcasters, who are strongly opposed to any proposals to open up the white spaces to unlicensed neighbors. They have been lobbying hard in Washington to discredit the potential of white space devices, claiming they can't coexist in harmony with mics and TV channels. New York, with its many Broadway and other entertainment venues, was a prime target for the industry spin. The New York City Council held a hearing this week on a proposed resolution to urge the FCC to refrain from authorizing unlicensed devices in the white spaces. But Feld says these airways are underutilized and will remain so without opening them up to new uses. He's a member of the Public Interest Spectrum Coalition, which is made up of public interest groups and technology companies.
we have a lot of other people who would like to use these empty channels between television stations, the broadcast white spaces. Before, wireless microphones were the only ones who were using it. Now, there is a lot of interest in using that space. The technology companies and a lot of public interest groups who see this as a important way to get rural broadband and broadband in underserved urban areas want it for unlicensed use.
Feld understands that wireless mics have now been woven into the fabric of our cultural life. He's working to preserve wireless mic use without interfering with public safety services or jeopardizing the productive use of the white spaces that could provide better broadband services to those who need it.
What we say is, look, move the wireless microphone guys out of the channels that are being returned because you can't mess with public safety and you can't mess with these new commercial services that are coming in. Recognize these uses and open it up in a real way on the remaining channels, but make them co-equal with any devices that you authorize for broadband use in the white spaces, because frankly, you know, the wireless microphones were there first, but they were illegally there first, so they shouldn't really get a benefit from having been there illegally.
To learn more about white spaces, visit freepress.net/white spaces. Internet radio stations got another stay of execution this week. In a surprising turn of events, Congress passed the Webcaster Settlement Act, which allows Internet radio broadcasters to negotiate for lower royalty rates than those mandated by the Copyright Royalty Board in a controversial decision last March. Webcasters faced increased payments of 300 to 1,200%, a spike in costs that would have forced popular sites like Pandora.com out of business. In response, Congress was flooded with hundreds of thousands of calls from angry Internet radio listeners. But legislation stalled in the face of intense lobbying from the big record labels and the National Association of Broadcasters. The bipartisan bill, introduced by Washington Congressman Jay Inslee shortly before Congress prepared to adjourn, permits a negotiated settlement between webcasters and Sound Exchange, the company that collects royalties for performers and the record industry. The fate of Internet radio remains up in the air, as rates will still need to be negotiated over the coming months. For more information on the Webcaster Royalty Rate Debate, go to savenetradio.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Welcome to the Weekly Radio Spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Diane Farsetta.
And I'm Sari Williams. In our top spin, the U.S. Interior Department has been rocked by scandal. Officials who collect royalties from oil and gas companies were recently outed for allegedly accepting gifts from those companies. There is evidence the government employees also used cocaine and had sex with industry representatives. But here is the real problem. Officials in another Interior Department agency might have met with environmentalists. At least that's the concern of Americans for American Energy, or AAE. AAE is a pro-drilling front group formed by a public relations firm. AAE is concerned that officials at Interior's National Landscape Conservation System might have shared information with the Wilderness Society and National Wildlife Federation. It's asking Congress to investigate and to stop action on two bills it feels might have been compromised. AAE also accused the Wilderness Society and National Wildlife Federation of, quote, pursuing an anti-American energy political agenda, end quote.
Foreign governments often turn to Washington, D.C. lobbying firms and think tanks to boost their political clout. But secretly involving a prestigious research university is another matter. That's what the government of Kazakhstan did with help from their public relations firm, APCO Worldwide. APCO approached the Central Asia Caucasus Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Through APCO, the Kazakh government paid Johns Hopkins to author three reports about Kazakhstan and to sponsor think tank discussions of the reports. Neither the university nor the institute disclosed the Kazakh government funding. The director of the institute said they were in touch with APCO, not the Kazakh government, and had full editorial control over the reports.
The International Monetary Fund and World Bank are so unpopular that they routinely inspire large protests, like this one outside their April 2000 meeting in Washington, D.C.
It's the bad things that are being globalized, like inequality, like environmental injustice. We're globalizers as well, but we're globalizing our resistance to capital.
Dr. New York! Oh, the IMF has got to go!
But better times are ahead for the International Monetary Fund, or IMF. They recently hired the major public relations firm Hill & Knowlton. Hill and Knowlton will help the IMF with global outreach, leading PR teams across the Middle East, North Africa, Central Asia, and the Far East. The PR firm will also draft for the IMF, quote, customized contract programs with key opinion formers, influencers, and the wider financial and economic community, end quote. Presumably, the Black Bloc and other IMF protesters won't be invited.
After multiple scandals over unsafe drugs, tainted vegetables, and other dangerous products, the U.S. Food and Drug Agency is boosting its public relations efforts. The agency hired a PR consultant to work with its top officials for 2 years. The consultant then decided the FDA needed even more PR help, so she contacted friends at Corvus Communications, a public relations firm that also works for the drug industry group Pharma. As if that weren't bad enough, the consultant then worked with Corvus to bend the rules and award the PR firm a $300,000 no-bid contract. They claimed that the contract would go to an Alaska-based firm that can receive no-bid contracts because it's a native-owned company. After the deception was revealed, the FDA suspended the PR contract. Ironically, the stated goal of the contract was to, quote, create and foster a lasting positive public image of the agency for the American public, end quote.
And now it's time to play 6 Degrees of Spin and Fakin, our look at the connections between media manipulators. Earlier, we mentioned Americans for American Energy. This patriotic-sounding front group was formed by the public relations firm PacWest Communications after it received $3 million from the state of Alaska to promote drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. In July 2008, Americans for American Energy took part in a campaign called Stop the War on the Poor. The campaign also included the Congress of Racial Equality, which has received funding from ExxonMobil. The campaign claimed that increasing domestic drilling would reduce energy costs. However, U.S. government data shows there would only be a very small price drop decades from now.
That's this week's edition of the Weekly Radio Spin. For more information, visit the Center for Media and Democracy's website at www.prwatch.org.
Thank you. And now the winner of the Best Central Wisconsin Community Radio Station is voted by us computer voices. WNRB.
Women's E-News, weekly summary of news about women, women's issues, and from women's perspectives. From the weekly Cheers and Jeers column of October 4th, 2008. I'm Sandy Billings. Let's start with the good news. Cheers! Women receive awards for doing good deeds. Three women and a couple won the 2008 Right Livelihood Awards on October 1st. The awards honor independent journalism, economic balance, peace building, social justice, and eradication of poverty, and is also known as the Alternative Nobel. The award is given by the Right Livelihood Awards Foundation. U.S. journalist Amy Goodman, founder and host of the radio and TV program Democracy Now!, was honored for her independent political journalism. Through Democracy Now!, Amy offers space to unpopular voices and the opportunity for millions of people to hear them. Somalian activist Asha Hagi, the co-founder of Save Somali Women and Children, was honored for her effort to mobilize women in the decision-making and clan-based mediations of her war-ravaged nation. German gynecologist Monika Hauser of Medica Mondial was recognized for her commitment to seek punishment and compensation for women who are sexually abused in wartime. Married Indian activist Krishnamal and Sankara Lingam Jagannathan founded the social justice group Land for the Tillers Freedom. They were honored for carrying the legacy of Mahatma Gandhi by working on human sustainability issues for landless people in India. More news to cheer this week. The Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund endorsed 100 openly lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender political candidates in 2008. The Political Action Committee says it is a record year for LGBT candidates running for all levels of political office. Indira Nooyi, chair and CEO of PepsiCo, takes the number one spot in Fortune's list of the 50 most powerful women in for-profit companies in its latest issue. The Debbie Smith Act, which is the law authorizing funding to reduce the DNA testing backlog in rape cases, was reauthorized by Congress. The announcement came from the office of Representative Carolyn B. Maloney, a Democrat out of New York, who sponsored the bill. Maloney said, quote, "Every unprocessed rape kit represents a victim who has been denied justice. DNA evidence puts rapists behind bars," unquote. The Future Church is lobbying to reinstate passages that refer to women into the Catholic lectionary. The lectionary is a collection of biblical passages selected specifically by the church. The Future Church argues that women's relevance in Catholic teachings have been historically overlooked or deleted. The Feminist Political Education Project has demanded an equal share of power in Zimbabwe by 2015. This women's rights group made its demands a few days after the country's main political party signed a power-sharing agreement. Only one of eight negotiators in the agreement was female. Now for the downside of the news, jeers for news that the U.S. halts condoms to Africa. Free condom delivery through programs run by Marie Stopes International has been seriously disrupted in Ghana, Malawi, Sierra Leone, Tanzania, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. This because the U.S. Agency for International Development invoked the so-called global gag rule to end deliveries of condoms to the organization. In a statement, Marie Stopes chief Dana Hovig said the aid was cut off because the group works in China, whose government, USAID, accuses of engaging in forced abortions. The gag rule bars U.S. funding for any group that offers abortion services, counseling, or lobbies to change abortion laws. Hovig called the cutoff purely political and dangerous to the lives of women, since women in the six African nations will be left with few options other than dangerous, illegal abortions. In 2007, Marie Stopes' aid work helped prevent 12.5 million unintended pregnancies. The U.S. government is also threatening to withhold $262 million in funding from California state programs that provide contraceptive services, prenatal care to pregnant women, and testing for sexually transmitted diseases to 1.7 million low-income people. The Bush administration wants the state to change its method for counting the number of undocumented immigrants who use the programs because they are prohibited from receiving assistance as a matter of federal policy. The state says the programs save taxpayers $1.4 billion annually by preventing 170,000 unintended pregnancies each year. More news to jeer this week. Malalai Kakar, a high-profile female police captain, was shot and killed by the Taliban in Afghanistan. Kakar was an advocate for greater freedom for Afghan women and led the unit that investigates crimes against women for the Kandahar police. She was the mother of six. Republican legislators in Utah plan to sponsor state legislation banning abortions in nearly all cases. The ban would allow exceptions for rape, incest, and to save the life of the woman. The coalition says the proposed bill will serve as a challenge to the 1973 Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision and said an unidentified Washington-based organization would bear the costs of defending the legislation in courts. John Labruzzo, a Republican state representative from Louisiana, is studying a proposal to pay low-income women $1,000 to have their tubes tied as an anti-poverty measure. Labruzzo said he worried that people who receive food stamps and subsidized housing have higher birth rates than more affluent people, and that the birth rates contribute to higher costs for social welfare programs. That belief has been widely discredited. Zulus eagerly defy a year-old South African government ban on what's called virginity testing, in which girls under 16 years old present themselves to tribal leaders to have their genitals inspected. Supporters of the traditional practice say it helps prevent teen pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases. Opponents say it stigmatizes those who fail the test and puts others at risk for rape. In this region devastated by AIDS, some people believe that men can be cured if they have sex with a virgin. These news briefs were compiled by Julia Angeliscu, Jennifer Thurston, and Rita Henley Jensen. Rita Henley Jensen is the editor-in-chief. Background music is by Joan Hickey. This production of Women's E-News is brought to you by VP Foundation and Yen Radio. This column and more news about women can be found at the Women's E-News website, womensenews.org. For Yen Radio, I'm Sandy Billings.
You know you only had one shot to make it right, to do the right thing. So listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. The economic catastrophe caused by unregulated free market irresponsibility threatens millions of working people, as well as the entire U.S. financial system. Economist Josh Bivens at the Economic Policy Institute believes a bailout is needed, but it should be targeted to cushion the economic blow to working people.
Essentially, it will transform what could be a real economic disaster back into just sort of the garden variety recession that we're in right now.
Ed Ott is executive director of the New York City Central Labor Council. He wants to see direct aid to the millions of people at risk of losing their homes.
Money in there so that people can refinance where it's necessary. We'd like to see them use the force of the law to suspend all foreclosures.
The California Nurses Association is sponsoring a new ad highlighting some of GOP vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin's comments. It's called One Heartbeat Away. Here's an excerpt from the ad campaign.
What is it exactly that the VP does?
What insight into Russian actions, particularly in the last couple of weeks, does the proximity of the state give you?
They're our next-door neighbors, and you can actually see Russia from land here in Alaska.
Do you agree with the Bush Doctrine?
In what respect, Charlie?
Machinists at Boeing remain steadfast on the picket lines. According to Business Week magazine, the strike is costing Boeing more than it would have cost to meet the union's pension demands. IAM's Tom Robleski.
Our members are committed. They tell me that they are here to do whatever it takes to win this battle against the Boeing company.
The AFL-CIO is launching a new campaign reaching out to over a million union swing voters on the health care issue. The effort is targeted in battleground states, including Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. It centers on John McCain's proposal to tax employer-based health care benefits and essentially privatize Medicare. The AFL-CIO calls it a risky health care scheme that just further burdens already economically struggling workers and middle-class families. A mass mailing, a million leaflets, more than 150,000 phone calls, and home visits in Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Ohio are all part of this campaign. The AFL-CIO is in the midst of its largest campaign mobilization in history, contacting over 13 million voters in 24 priority states. Quest workers have rejected a new 3-year contract proposal. Jesse Russell reports.
Quest workers, represented by the Communication Workers of America, voted against a new 3-year contract proposal on Tuesday. Although the authority to call a strike had been given to negotiators when the contract expired in August, both sides say negotiations are ongoing and no strike is in the forecast. 20,000 Quest employees in 13 states are represented by the CWA.
Help keep labor's voice on the air and get more labor news at laborradio.org. Workers' Independent News, we can review. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
Biology professor David Ehrenfeld, when he was a medical student, was part of a small group of students meeting with a celebrated cardiologist, who was then in his 80s. One of the students exclaimed that heart disease was the number one cause of death in the United States. Ehrenfeld recounts, "Our teacher thought about this for a while and answered, 'What would you prefer to have as a number one cause of death?' 'Death is inevitable,' the cardiologist seemed to suggest, 'not a problem to be solved by preventing its number one cause.' I think about the cardiologist's question when looking at the current financial meltdown. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson has earnestly explained this past week that bad lending practices are the number one cause of the collapse of the U.S. financial system. What would he prefer to have as a primary cause of the collapse? Unlike human death, economic collapse is not inevitable. However, the U.S. economy has long been on a trajectory towards such massive change that collapse is not too strong a word. Our country has squandered its post-World War II prosperity, much of it on investments unsuited to the 21st century. The U.S. overextended itself, building a system of interstate highways and smaller roads and bridges that neither the states nor the federal government can seem to find the money to maintain. When we're lucky, locally vital bridges are closed before they collapse, as has happened twice in the last few months here in Vermont. When we're unlucky, as they were in Minneapolis last year, an 8-lane bridge collapses while filled with rush hour traffic. James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency, has called post-war sprawl perhaps the greatest misallocation of resources the world has ever known. Suburbs and the isolated country homes that we have so many of in Vermont require large infusions of oil. Oil moves people back and forth to work, play, shopping, and worship. Oil brings in food and goods, and carries away garbage. As oil production reaches a peak, and then declines, Kunstler expects sprawl to leave a legacy of ghost suburbs and radically altered living arrangements. Those suburbs that are not abandoned will be sparsely occupied, with lawns turned into mini-farms. Proud family McMansions will be subdivided into apartments by owners who can't afford to live in them alone. People will be concentrated along rail or bus lines, and those left living in the countryside will be isolated, their trips to town infrequent at best. The collapse of the housing bubble and high energy prices are already starting to realize Kunstler's expectation. Subdivisions are being abandoned, half-built, and home values are dropping faster in outlying areas than in or near city centers. Kunstler's background is in theater, journalism, and writing novels and nonfiction books. Numerous people with much different, more technocratic backgrounds have come to similar conclusions about the underlying economic trends. They come from top government contractors, Vice President Dick Cheney's secretive energy task force, and even Congress itself. What's the best way to spend our money as the industrial economy and whole patterns of living are dramatically rearranged? Not on bailing out automakers, as Congress just allocated $25 billion towards. We need strong investment in efficiency, converting to renewable energy, strengthening local agriculture, better rail and other public transit, and anything that builds stronger communities and protects the most vulnerable. Personal investment in preparedness is important, too. Warren Buffett thinks this is a time to invest $5 billion in Goldman Sachs. Me? I finally ordered that cider press I'd been eyeing. And I'm thinking of joining the co-op formed by some neighbors for a small-scale dry bean thresher and winnower. And I'm learning local wild edibles at Wisdom of the Herb School and using permaculture design principles to turn our yard into a woodland garden. So what do I want the primary cause of U.S. financial collapse to be? Well, I can better answer the question of how I prefer to see the collapse happen. I'd like to see it happen slowly, with enough small scares to wake people up to the scale of the problem, while we still have significant resources to invest in a transition to a post-oil economy. I'd like to see financial collapse treated as an opportunity for neighbors to help neighbors, for communities to meet the challenge of providing essential goods and services for themselves. And I'd like to see us sing and dance and laugh together as we make the transition. If we're going to change almost everything about our lives, we might as well have some fun doing it. I'm Carl Ettenayer, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
Yeah, hi, it's Bill Lumberg. It's about 10 o'clock. I just wanted to make sure you knew that we did start at the usual time this morning. Yeah, it isn't a half day or anything like that. So if you could just go ahead and get here as soon as possible, that would be terrific.
It's time to ask Mr. Green from the Sierra Club. Bill in University Place, Washington asks, "Hey, Mr. Green, what is the correct temperature for my refrigerator and freezer? I want to make sure I'm not wasting energy."
Well, Phil, the best thing to do is to set the fridge between 35 and 38 degrees Fahrenheit and the freezer at zero. And because it takes more energy to keep a freezer cold if it's empty, make sure to keep it filled. If necessary, you can use jugs of water or ice. Standing there with the door open pondering what to eat is an indisputable juice drain, so keep that door closed. If you want to get even better energy savings, visit EnergyStar.gov to find Energy Star appliances. These are more efficient models that will save energy and save you money on your bills. So remember, set that fridge between 35 and 38 degrees Fahrenheit and set the freezer at zero. And for the best energy savings, look for an efficient Energy Star model.
Ask Mr. Green and learn a lot more online at SierraClubRadio.org.
Wake up. Sunday mornings, the irreverent Uncle Pete. With your Sunday morning soft start, 8 to 10 a.m.
You must wake up.
Uncle Pete will bring you a kinder, gentler radio wake-up call.
Come on, wake up.
That's Sunday mornings, 8 to 10 a.m.
Wake up, love.
That soft starts Sunday mornings, 8 to 10 a.m. Only on 93.3 WNRB LP, Wausau.